Armed beast. Don't hold yourself away from me, John, she was commanding in a voice of harsh mockery. You know it won't do any good. This is the night of the full moon, and I have power for anything. Anything. She was trying to drag his arm away from his face. You won't gain by... She broke off aghast, then in a wild, dry-throated scream, You're not John! Poe whipped over on his back, and his bird claw hands shot out and seized her, one hand clinching upon her snaky disorder of dark hair, the other digging its fingertips into the chill flesh of her arm. The scream quivered away into a horrible, breathless rattle. Poe dragged his captive violently inwards, throwing all his collected strength into the effort. Her feet were jerked from the floor, and she flew into the recess, hurtling above and beyond Poe's recumbent body. She struck the inner stones with a crashing force that might break bones, and would have collapsed upon Poe, but at the same moment he had released her and slid swiftly out upon the floor of the cellar. With frantic haste, he seized the edge of the back-flung trapdoor. Elva Gobber struggled upon hands and knees among the tumbled bedclothes in the niche, then Poe had slammed the panel shut. She threw herself against it from within, yammering and wailing like an animal in a trap. She was almost as strong as he, and for a moment he thought that she would burst out of the niche, but sweating and wheezing, he bore against the planks with his shoulder, bracing his feet against the earth. His fingers found the latch, lifted it, forced it into place. Dark, moaned Elva Gobber from inside. Dark, no moon. Her voice trailed off. Poe went to the muddy pool in the corner, thrust in his hands. The mud was slimy but workable. He pushed a double handful of it against the trap door, sealing cracks and edges. Another handful. Another. Using his palms like trowels, he coated the boards with thick mud. Gobber, he said breathlessly, how are you? All right, I think. The voice was strangely strong and clear. Looking over his shoulder, Poe saw that Gobber had come upright of himself, still pale but apparently steady. What are you doing? Gobber asked. Walling her up, jerked out Poe, scooping still more mud. Walling her up forever with her evil. He had a momentary flash of inspiration, a symbolic germ of a story. In it, a man sealed a woman into such a nook of the wall, and with her an embodiment of active evil, perhaps in the form of a black cat. Pausing at last to breathe deeply, he smiled to himself. Even in the direst of danger, the most heartbreaking moment of toil and fear, he must ever be coining up new plots for stories. I cannot thank you enough, Gobber was saying to him. I feel that all will be well, if only she stays there. Poe put his ear to the wall. Not a whisper of motion, sir. She's shut off from moonlight, from life and power. Can you help me with my clothes? I feel terribly chilled. His mother-in-law met him on the threshold when he returned to the house in Spring Garden Street. Under the white widow's cap, her strong, boned face was drawn with worry.
Eddie, are you ill?
She was really asking if he had been drinking. A look reassured her.
No, she answered herself, but you've been away from home so long, and you're dirty, Eddie, filthy. You must wash.
He let her lead him in, pour hot water into a basin. As he scrubbed himself, he formed excuses, a banal lie about a long walk for inspiration, a moment of dizzy weariness, a stumble into a mud puddle.
I'll make you some nice hot coffee, Eddie, his mother-in-law offered.
Please, he responded, and went back to his own room with the slate mantelpiece. Again, he lighted the candle, sat down, and took up his pen. His mind was embellishing the story inspiration that had come to him at such a black moment in the cellar of the Gobber house. He'd work on that tomorrow. The United States Saturday Post would take it, he hoped. Title? He would call it simply, The Black Cat. But to finish the present task, he dipped his pen in ink. How to begin? How to end? How, after writing and publishing such an account, to defend himself against the growing whisper of his insanity? He decided to forget it, if he could, at least to seek healthy company, comfort, quiet, perhaps even to write some light verse, some humorous articles and stories. For the first time in his life, he had had enough of the macabre. Quickly, he wrote a final paragraph.
There are moments when, even to the sober eye of reason, the world of our sad humanity may assume the semblance of a hell. But the imagination of man is no Carathis, to explore with impunity its every cavern. Alas, the grim legion of sepulchral terrors cannot be regarded as altogether fanciful, but like the demons in whose company Afrasiab made his voyage down the Oxus, they must sleep, or they will devour us. They must be suffered to slumber, or we will perish. That would do for the public, decided Edgar Allan Poe. In any case, it would do for the Philadelphia Dollar newspaper. His mother-in-law brought in the coffee.
The Drifting Snow by August Derleth. August William Derleth, 1909 to 1971, was born in Sauk City, Wisconsin, where he remained his entire life. He received an M.A. from the University of Wisconsin in 1930, by which time he had already begun to sell horror stories to Weird Tales, the first appearing in 1926, and other pulp magazines, sometimes in collaboration with his boyhood friend Mark Shorer, but more frequently by himself. During his lifetime, he wrote more than 3,000 stories and articles, and published more than 100 books, including detective stories, featuring Judge Peck and an American Sherlock Holmes clone, Solar Pons, supernatural stories, and what he regarded as his serious fiction, a very lengthy series of books, stories, poems, journals, etc., about life in his small town, which he renamed Sac Prairie. Derleth was almost single-handedly responsible for recognizing and celebrating the work of H.P. Lovecraft, who had enjoyed little success in his lifetime. Derleth took his Cthulhu mythos, dominated by the evil Old Ones, and expanded it to include the benevolent Elder Gods, featuring them in numerous pulp stories. Later, in what may have been his most important contribution to the horror fiction genre, he founded Arkham House with Donald Wandre, publishing many volumes of Lovecraft's work, while also publishing the first work of such future giants of the genre as Robert Bloch, Fritz Leiber, Ray Bradbury, and Joseph Payne Brennan. The Drifting Snow was first published in the February 1939 issue of Weird Tales.
The Drifting Snow by August Derleth. Read by Carrington McDuffie. Aunt Mary's advancing footsteps halted suddenly, short of the table, and Claudetta turned to see what was keeping her. She was standing very rigidly, her eyes fixed upon the French windows just opposite the door through which she had entered, her cane held stiffly before her. Claudetta shot a quick glance across the table toward her husband, whose attention had also been drawn to his aunt. His face vouchsafed her nothing. She turned again to find that the old lady had transferred her gaze to her, regarding her stonily and in silence. Claudetta felt uncomfortable. "Who withdrew the curtains from the west windows?" Claudetta flushed, remembering. "I did, Aunt. I'm sorry, I forgot about your not wanting them drawn away." The old lady made an odd grunting sound, shifting her gaze once again to the French windows. She made a barely perceptible movement, and Lisa ran forward from the shadow of the hall, where she had been regarding the two at table with stern disapproval. The servant went directly to the west windows and drew the curtains. Aunt Mary came slowly to the table and took her place at its head. She put her cane against the side of her chair, pulled at the chain around her neck so that her lorgnette lay in her lap, and looked from Claudetta to her nephew, Ernest. Then she fixed her gaze on the empty chair at the foot of the table and spoke without seeming to see the two beside her. "I told both of you that none of the curtains over the west windows was to be withdrawn after sundown, and you must have noticed that none of those windows has been for one instant uncovered at night. I took especial care to put you in rooms facing east, and the sitting room is also in the east." "I'm sure Claudetta didn't mean to go against your wishes, Aunt Mary," said Ernest abruptly.
"No, of course not, Aunt."
The old lady raised her eyebrows and went on impassively. "I didn't think it wise to explain why I made such a request. I'm not going to explain, but I do want to say that there is a very definite danger in drawing away the curtains.
Ernest has heard that before, but you, Claudetta, have not.
Claudetta shot a startled glance at her husband. The old lady caught it and said, "It's all very well to believe that my mind's wandering, or that I'm getting eccentric, but I shouldn't advise you to be satisfied with that." A young man came suddenly into the room and made for the seat at the foot of the table, into which he flung himself with an almost inaudible greeting to the other three.
"Late again, Henry," said the old lady.
Henry mumbled something and began hurriedly to eat. The old lady sighed and began presently to eat also, whereupon Claudetta and Ernest did likewise. The old servant, who had continued to linger behind Aunt Mary's chair, now withdrew, not without a scornful glance at Henry. Claudetta looked up after a while and ventured to speak.
"You aren't as isolated as I thought you might be up here, Aunt Mary."
"We aren't, my dear, what with telephones and cars and all. But only 20 years ago it was quite a different thing, I can tell you."
She smiled reminiscently and looked at Ernest.
"Your grandfather was living then, and many's the time he was snowbound with no way to let anybody know."
"Down in Chicago, when they speak of up north or the Wisconsin woods, it seems very far away," said Claudetta.
"Well, it is far away,"
put in Henry abruptly.
"And, Aunt, I hope you've made some provision in case we're locked in here for a day or two. It looks like snow outside, and the radio says a blizzard's coming."
The old lady grunted and looked at him.
"Ha, Henry, you're overly concerned, it seems to me. I'm afraid you've been regretting this trip ever since you set foot in my house. If you're worrying about a snowstorm, I can have Sam drive you down to Wausau, and you can be in Chicago tomorrow."
"Of course not."
Silence fell, and presently the old lady called gently, "Lisa," and the servant came into the room to help her from her chair, though, as Claudetta had previously said to her husband, she didn't need help. From the doorway, Aunt Mary bade them all good night, looking impressively formidable with her cane in one hand and her unopened lorgnette in the other, and vanished into the dusk of the hall, from which her receding footsteps sounded together with those of the servant, who was seldom seen away from her. These two were alone in the house most of the time, and only very brief periods when the old lady had up her nephew Ernest, dear John's boy, or Henry, of whose father the old lady never spoke, helped to relieve the pleasant somnolence of their quiet lives. Sam, who usually slept in the garage, did not count. Claudetta looked nervously at her husband, but it was Henry who said what was uppermost in their thoughts.
"I think she's losing her mind,"
he declared matter-of-factly. Cutting off Claudetta's protest on her lips, he got up and went into the sitting room, from which came presently the strains of music from the radio. Claudetta fingered her spoon idly, and finally said,
"I do think she is a little queer, Ernest."
Ernest smiled tolerantly.
"No, I don't think so. I've an idea why she keeps the west windows covered. My grandfather died out there. He was overcome by the cold one night and froze on the slope of the hill. I don't rightly know how it happened. I was away at the time. I suppose she doesn't like to be reminded of it."
"But where's the danger she spoke of, then?"
He shrugged.
"Perhaps it lies in her. She might be affected, and affect us in turn."
He paused for an instant, and finally added,
"I suppose she does seem a little strange to you, but she was like that as long as I can remember. Next time you come, you'll be used to it."
Claudetta looked at her husband for a moment before replying. At last she said,
"I don't think I like the house, Ernest."
"Oh, nonsense, darling."
He started to get up, but Claudetta stopped him.
"Listen, Ernest, I remembered perfectly well Aunt Mary's not wanting those curtains drawn away, but I just felt I had to do it. I didn't want to, but something made me do it."
Her voice was unsteady.
"Why, Claudetta,"
he said, faintly alarmed.
"Why didn't you tell me before?"
She shrugged.
"Aunt Mary might have thought I'd gone wool gathering."
"Well, it's nothing serious. But you've let it bother you a little, and that isn't good for you. Forget it. Think of something else. Come and listen to the radio.
They rose and moved toward the sitting room together. At the door, Henry met them. He stepped aside a little, saying,
"I might have known we'd be marooned up here,"
and adding, as Claudetta began to protest,
"We're going to be all right. There's a wind coming up, and it's beginning to snow, and I know what that means."
He passed them and went into the deserted dining room, where he stood a moment, looking at the too long table. Then he turned aside and went over to the French windows, from which he drew away the curtains and stood there, peering out into the darkness. Ernest saw him standing at the window and protested from the sitting room.
"Aunt Mary doesn't like those windows uncovered, Henry."
Henry half turned and replied,
"Well, she may think it's dangerous, but I can risk it."
Claudetta, who had been staring beyond Henry into the night through the French windows, said suddenly,
"Why, there's someone out there."
Henry looked quickly through the glass and replied,
"No, that's the snow. It's coming down heavily, and the wind's drifting it this way and that."
He dropped the curtains and came away from the windows. Claudetta said uncertainly,
"Why, I could have sworn I saw someone out there, walking past the window."
"I suppose it does look that way from here," offered Henry, who had come back into the sitting room. "But personally, I think you've let Aunt Mary's eccentricities impress you too much."
Ernest made an impatient gesture at this, and Claudetta did not answer. Henry sat down before the radio and began to move the dial slowly. Ernest had found himself a book and was becoming interested, but Claudetta continued to sit with her eyes fixed upon the still slowly moving curtains cutting off the French windows. Presently, she got up and left the room, going down the long hall into the east wing, where she tapped gently upon Aunt Mary's door.
"Come in," called the old lady.
Claudetta opened the door and stepped into the room, where Aunt Mary sat in her dressing robe, her dignity, in the shape of her lorgnette and cane, resting respectively on her bureau and in the corner. She looked surprisingly benign, as Claudetta at once confessed.
"Ha! Thought I was an ogre in disguise, did you?"
said the old lady, smiling in spite of herself.
"I'm really not, you see, but I am a sort of bogey about the west windows, as you have seen."
"I wanted to tell you something about those windows, Aunt Mary," said Claudetta.
She stopped suddenly. The expression on the old lady's face had given way to a curiously dismaying one. It was not anger, not distaste. It was a lurking suspense. Why, the old lady was afraid.
"What?"
she asked Claudetta shortly.
"I was looking out, just for a moment or so, and I thought I saw someone out there."
"Of course you didn't, Claudetta. Your imagination, perhaps, or the drifting snow."
"My imagination? Maybe, but there was no wind to drift the snow, though one has come up since."
"I've often been fooled that way, my dear. Sometimes I've gone out in the morning to look for footprints. There weren't any, ever. We're pretty far away from civilization in a snowstorm, despite our telephones and radios. Our nearest neighbor is at the foot of the long, sloping rise, over 3 miles away, and all the wooded land between. There's no highway nearer than that."
"It was so clear, I could have sworn to it."
"Do you want to go out in the morning and look?"
asked the old lady shortly.
"Of course not."
"Then you didn't see anything?"
It was half question, half demand. Claudetta said,
"Oh, Aunt Mary, you're making an issue of it now."
"Did you or didn't you, in your own mind, see anything, Claudetta?"
"I guess I didn't, Aunt Mary."
"Very well. And now, do you think we might talk about something more pleasant?"
"Why, I'm sure. I'm sorry, Aunt. I didn't know that Ernest's grandfather had died out there."
"Ha! He's told you that, has he? Well?"
"Yes, he said that was why you didn't like the slope after sunset, that you didn't like to be reminded of his death."
The old lady looked at Claudetta impassively.
Perhaps he'll never know how nearly right he was.
What do you mean, Aunt Mary?
Nothing for you to know, my dear.
She smiled again, her sternness dropping from her.
And now I think you'd better go, Claudetta. I'm tired.
Claudetta rose obediently and made for the door, where the old lady stopped her.
How's the weather?
It's snowing. Hard, Henry says, and blowing. The old lady's face showed her distaste at the news.
I don't like to hear that, not at all. Suppose someone should look down that slope tonight.
She was speaking to herself, having forgotten Claudetta at the door. Seeing her again abruptly, she said,
But you don't know, Claudetta. Good night.
Claudetta stood with her back against the closed door, wondering what the old lady could have meant.
But you don't know, Claudetta.
That was curious. For a moment or two, the old lady had completely forgotten her. She moved away from the door and came upon Ernest just turning into the east wing.
Oh, there you are, he said. I wondered where you had gone.
I was talking a bit with Aunt Mary.
Henry's been at the west windows again, and now he thinks there's someone out there.
Claudetta stopped short. Does he really think so? Ernest nodded gravely.
But the snow's drifting frightfully, and I can imagine how that suggestion of yours worked on his mind.
Claudetta turned and went back along the hall.
I'm going to tell Aunt Mary.
He started to protest, but to no avail, for she was already tapping on the old lady's door, and indeed opening the door and entering the room before he could frame an adequate protest.
Aunt Mary, she said, I didn't want to disturb you again, but Henry's been at the French windows in the dining room, and he says he's seen someone out there.
The effect on the old lady was magical.
He's seen them, she exclaimed.
Then she was on her feet, coming rapidly over to Claudetta.
How long ago?
She demanded, seizing her almost roughly by the arms.
Tell me, quickly, how long ago did he see them?
Claudetta's amazement kept her silent for a moment, but at last she spoke, feeling the old lady's keen eyes staring at her.
It was some time ago, Aunt Mary, after supper.
The old lady's hands relaxed, and with it her tension.
Oh,
she said, and turned and went back slowly to her chair, taking her cane from the corner where she had put it for the night.
Then there is someone out there?
Challenged Claudetta, when the old lady had reached her chair. For a long time, it seemed to Claudetta, there was no answer. Then presently, the old lady began to nod gently, and a barely audible yes escaped her lips.
Then we had better take them in, Aunt Mary.
The old lady looked at Claudetta earnestly for a moment. Then she replied, her voice firm and low, her eyes fixed upon the wall beyond.
We can't take them in, Claudetta, because they're not alive.
At once Henry's words came flashing into Claudetta's memory, she's losing her mind, and her involuntary start betrayed her thought.
I'm afraid I'm not mad, my dear. I hoped at first I might be, but I wasn't. I'm not now. There was only one of them out there at first, the girl. Father is the other. Quite long ago, when I was young, my father did something which he regretted all his days. He had a too strong temper, and it maddened him. One night, he found out that one of my brothers, Henry's father, had been very familiar with one of the servants, a very pretty girl, older than I was. He thought she was to blame, though she wasn't, and he didn't find it out until too late. He drove her from the house then and there. Winter had not yet set in, but it was quite cold, and she had some 5 miles to go to her home. We begged Father not to send her away, though we didn't know what was wrong then, but he paid no attention to us. The girl had to go. Not long after she had gone, a biting wind came up, and close upon it, a fierce storm. Father had already repented his hasty action and sent some of the men to look for the girl. They didn't find her, but in the morning she was found frozen to death on the long slope of the hill to the west.
The old lady sighed, paused a moment, and went on.
Years later, she came back. She came in a snowstorm as she went, but she had become a vampire. We all saw her. We were at the supper table, and Father saw her first. The boys had already gone upstairs, and Father and the two of us girls, my sister and I, did not recognize her. She was just a dim shape, floundering around in the drifting snow beyond the French windows. Father ran out to her, calling to us to send the boys after him. We never saw him alive again. In the morning, we found him in the same spot where years before the girl had been found. He, too, had died of exposure. Then, a few years after, she returned with the snow, and she brought him along. He, too, had become a vampire. They stayed until the last snow, always trying to lure someone out there. After that, I knew, and had the windows covered during the winter nights, from sunset to dawn, because they never went beyond the west slope. Now you know, Claudetta.
Whatever Claudetta was going to say was cut short by running footsteps in the hall, a hasty rap, and Ernest's head appearing suddenly in the open doorway.
Come on, you two, he said, almost gaily. There are people out on the west slope, a girl and an old man, and Henry's gone out to fetch them in.
Then, triumphant, he was off. Claudetta came to her feet, but the old lady was before her, passing her and almost running down the hall, calling loudly for Lisa, who presently appeared in nightcap and gown from her room.
"Call Sam, Lisa," said the old lady, "and send him to me in the dining room."
She ran on into the dining room, Claudetta close on her heels. The French windows were open, and Ernest stood on the snow-covered terrace beyond, calling his cousin. The old lady went directly over to him, even striding into the snow to his side, though the wind drove the snow against her with great force. The wooded western slope was lost in a snow fog. The nearest trees were barely discernible.
"Where could they have gone?" Ernest said,
turning to the old lady, whom he had thought to be Claudetta. Then, seeing that it was the old lady, he said,
"Why, Aunt Mary! And so little on, too! You'll catch your death of cold!"
"Never mind, Ernest," said the old lady. "I'm all right. I've had Sam get up to help you look for Henry, but I'm afraid you won't find him."
"He can't be far. He just now went out."
"He went before you saw where. He's far enough gone."
Sam came running into the blowing snow from the dining room, muffled in a greatcoat. He was considerably older than Ernest, almost the old lady's age. He shot a questioning glance at her and asked,
"Have they come again?"
Aunt Mary nodded.
"You'll have to look for Henry. Ernest will help you. And remember, don't separate, and don't go far from the house."
Claudetta came with Ernest's overcoat, and together the two women stood there, watching them until they were swallowed up in the wall of driven snow. Then they turned slowly and went back into the house. The old lady sank into a chair facing the windows. She was pale and drawn, and looked, as Claudetta said afterward, as if she'd fallen together. For a long time she said nothing. Then, with a gentle little sigh, she turned to Claudetta and spoke.
"Now there'll be three of them out there."
Then, so suddenly that no one knew how it happened, Ernest and Sam appeared beyond the windows, and between them they dragged Henry. The old lady flew to open the windows, and the three of them, cloaked in snow, came into the room.
"We found him, but the cold's hit him pretty hard, I'm afraid," said Ernest.
The old lady sent Lisa for cold water, and Ernest ran to get himself other clothes. Claudetta went with him,
and in their rooms told him what the old lady had related to her. Ernest laughed.
"I think you believed that, didn't you, Claudetta? Sam and Lisa do, I know, because Sam told me the story long ago. I think the shock of Grandfather's death was too much for all three of them."
"But the story of the girl, and then..."
"That part's true, I'm afraid. A nasty story, but it did happen."
"But those people Henry and I saw," protested Claudetta weakly. Ernest stood without movement.
"That's so," he said. "I saw them, too." "Then they're out there yet, and we'll have to find them."
He took up his overcoat again and went from the room, Claudetta protesting in a shrill, unnatural voice. The old lady met him at the door of the dining room, having overheard Claudetta pleading with him.
"No, Ernest, you can't go out there again," she said. "There's no one there."
He pushed gently into the room and called to Sam.
"Coming, Sam? There's still two of them out there. We almost forgot them."
Sam looked at him strangely.
"What do you mean?"
he demanded roughly. He looked challengingly at the old lady, who shook her head.
"The girl and the old man, Sam. We've got to get them, too."
"Oh, them,"
said Sam.
"They're dead."
"Then I'll go out alone," said Ernest.
Henry came to his feet suddenly, looking dazed. He walked forward a few steps, his eyes traveling from one to the other of them, yet apparently not seeing them. He began to speak abruptly, in an unnatural, childlike voice.
"The snow," he murmured. "The snow. The beautiful hands. So little, so lovely. Her beautiful hands. And the snow, the beautiful, lovely snow, drifting and falling around her."
He turned slowly and looked toward the French windows, the others following his gaze. Beyond was a wall of white, where the snow was drifting against the house. For a moment, Henry stood quietly watching. Then suddenly, a white figure came forward from the snow. A young girl, cloaked in long snow whips, her glistening eyes strangely fascinating. The old lady flung herself forward, her arms outstretched, to cling to Henry, but she was too late. Henry had run toward the windows, had opened them, and even as Claudetta cried out, had vanished into the wall of snow beyond. Then Ernest ran forward, but the old lady threw her arms around him and held him tightly, murmuring,
"You shall not go. Henry is gone beyond our help."
Claudetta came to help her, and Sam stood menacingly at the French windows, now closed against the wind and the sinister snow. So they held him and would not let him go.
"And tomorrow," said the old lady in a harsh whisper, "we must go to their graves and stake them down. We should have gone before."
In the morning, they found Henry's body crouched against the bole of an ancient oak, where the two others had been found years before. There were almost obliterated marks where something had dragged him, a long, uneven swath in the snow. And yet, no footprints, only strange, hollowed places along the way, as if the wind had whirled the snow away, and only the wind. But on his skin were signs of the snow vampire, the delicate small prints of a young girl's hands.
Almer Vance and the Vampire by Alice and Claude Askew. Alice Jane de Courcy, 1874 to 1917, was born in St. Pancras, London. Claude Arthur Carey Askew, 1866 to 1917, was born in Notting Hill, London, and was educated at Eton and on the Continent. They were married in 1900 and began a stunningly prolific writing collaboration that produced numerous newspaper serials, short stories, and more than 90 novels published between 1904 and a few years after their deaths, the result of a World War I submarine attack on their ship in the Mediterranean. Their first book, The Shulamite, 1904, was dramatized for the London stage by Claude Askew and Edward Knobloch. It was later made into silent films in 1915 and again in 1921 under the title Under the Lash. Other films based on their work were John Harriet's Wife, 1909, filmed in 1920, Testimony, 1909, filmed in 1926, Poison, 1913, filmed as The Playdell Mystery, 1916, and God's Clay, 1913, filmed in 1919. Although most of their novels and short stories were mystery and detective fiction, they also wrote romances, adventure novels, indeed every type of popular fiction, including one supernatural series about a psychic detective, or ghost hunter, which was not collected until Almer Vance, Ghost Seer, was published by Ash Tree Press in 1998. Almer Vance and the Vampire was first published in The Weekly Tale Teller, July 1914.
Almer Vance and the Vampire, by Alice and Claude Askew, read by Steve West. Almer Vance had rooms in Dover Street, Piccadilly, and now that I had decided to follow in his footsteps and to accept him as my instructor in matters psychic, I found it convenient to lodge in the same house. Almer and I quickly became close friends, and he showed me how to develop that faculty of clairvoyance which I had possessed without being aware of it. And I may say at once that this particular faculty of mine proved of service on several important occasions. At the same time, I made myself useful to Vance in other ways, not the least of which was that of acting as recorder of his many strange adventures. For himself, he never cared much about publicity, and it was some time before I could persuade him, in the interests of science, to allow me to give any detailed account of his experiences to the world. The incidents which I will now narrate occurred very soon after we had taken up our residence together, and while I was still, so to speak, a novice. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning that a visitor was announced. He sent up a card which bore upon it the name of Paul Davenant. The name was familiar to me, and I wondered if this could be the same Mr. Davenant who was so well known for his polo playing and for his success as an amateur rider, especially over the hurdles. He was a young man of wealth and position, and I recollected that he had married, about a year ago, a girl who was reckoned the greatest beauty of the season. All the illustrated papers had given their portraits at the time, and I remember thinking what a remarkably handsome couple they made. Mr. Davenant was ushered in, and at first I was uncertain as to whether this could be the individual whom I'd had in mind, so wan and pale and ill did he appear. A finely built, upstanding man at the time of his marriage, he had now acquired a languid droop of the shoulders and a shuffling gait, while his face, especially about the lips, was bloodless to an alarming degree. And yet it was the same man, for behind all this I could recognize the shadow of the good looks that had once distinguished Paul Davenant. He took the chair which Alma offered him, after the usual preliminary civilities had been exchanged, and then glanced doubtfully in my direction. "I wish to consult you privately, Mr. Vance," he said. "The matter is of considerable importance to myself, and, if I may say so, of a somewhat delicate nature." Of course I rose immediately to withdraw from the room, but Vance laid his hand upon my arm. "If the matter is connected with research in my particular line, Mr. Davenant," he said, "if there is any investigation you wish me to take up on your behalf, I shall be glad if you will include Mr. Dexter in your confidence. Mr. Dexter assists me in my work, but of course—" "Oh, no," interrupted the other. "If that is the case, pray let Mr. Dexter remain. I think," he added, glancing at me with a friendly smile, "that you are an Oxford man, are you not, Mr. Dexter? It was before my time, but I have heard of your name in connection with the river. You rode at Henley, unless I'm very much mistaken." I admitted the fact with a pleasurable sensation of pride. I was very keen upon rowing in those days, and a man's prowess at school and college always remains dear to his heart. After this we quickly became on friendly terms, and Paul Davenant proceeded to take Alma and myself into his confidence. He began by calling attention to his personal appearance.
"You would hardly recognize me for the same man I was a year ago," he said. "I've been losing flesh steadily for the last 6 months. I came up from Scotland about a week ago to consult a London doctor. I've seen two, in fact. They've held a sort of consultation over me, but the result, I may say, it's far from satisfactory. They don't seem to know what is really the matter with me."
"Anemia, heart," suggested Vance. He was scrutinizing his visitor keenly, and yet without any particular appearance of doing so. "I believe it not infrequently happens that you athletes overdo yourselves, put too much strain upon the heart."
"My heart is quite sound," responded Davenant. "Physically, it is in perfect condition. The trouble seems to be that it hasn't enough blood to pump into my veins. The doctors wanted to know if I had met with an accident involving a great loss of blood, but I haven't. I've had no accident at all, and as for anemia, well, I don't seem to show the ordinary symptoms of it. The inexplicable thing is that I've lost blood without knowing it, and apparently this has been going on for some time, for I've been getting steadily worse. It was almost imperceptible at first, not a sudden collapse, you understand, but a gradual failure of health."
"I wonder," remarked Vance slowly, "what induced you to consult me? For you know, of course, the direction in which I pursue my investigations. May I ask if you have reason to consider that your state of health is due to some cause which we may describe as superphysical?" A slight color came to Davenant's white cheeks.
"There are curious circumstances," he said in a low and earnest tone of voice. "I've been turning them over in my mind, trying to see light through them. I dare say it's all the sheerest folly, and I must tell you that I'm not in the least a superstitious sort of man. I don't mean to say that I'm absolutely incredulous, but I've never given thought to such things. I've led too active a life, but as I have said, there are curious circumstances about my case, and that is why I decided upon consulting you."
"Will you tell me everything without reserve?" said Vance. I could see that he was interested. He was sitting up in his chair, his feet supported on a stool, his elbows on his knees, his chin in his hands, a favorite attitude of his. "Have you," he suggested slowly, "any mark upon your body? Anything that you might associate, however remotely, with your present weakness and ill health?"
"It's a curious thing that you should ask me that question," returned Davenant, "because I have got a curious mark, a sort of scar, that I can't account for. But I showed it to the doctors, and they assured me that it could have nothing whatever to do with my condition. In any case, if it had, it was something altogether outside their experience. I think they imagined it to be nothing more than a birthmark, a sort of mole, for they asked me if I'd had it all my life. But that I can swear I haven't. I only noticed it for the first time about 6 months ago, when my health began to fail. But you can see for yourself."
He loosened his collar and bared his throat. Vance rose and made a careful scrutiny of the suspicious mark. It was situated a very little to the left of the central line, just above the clavicle, and, as Vance pointed out, directly over the big vessels of the throat. My friend called to me so that I might examine it too. Whatever the opinion of the doctors may have been, Alma was obviously deeply interested. And yet there was very little to show. The skin was quite intact, and there was no sign of inflammation. There were two red marks about an inch apart, each of which was inclined to be crescent in shape. They were more visible than they might otherwise have been, owing to the peculiar whiteness of Davenant's skin.
"It can't be anything of importance," said Davenant, with a slightly uneasy laugh. "I'm inclined to think that the marks are dying away."
"Have you ever noticed them more inflamed than they are at present?" inquired Vance. "If so, was it at any special time?" Davenant reflected.
"Yes," he replied slowly. "There have been times, usually, I think perhaps invariably, when I wake up in the morning, that I've noticed them larger and more angry-looking, and I've felt a slight sensation of pain, a tingling, oh, very slight, and I've never worried about it. Only now you suggest it to my mind, I believe that those same mornings I have felt particularly tired and done up, a sensation of lassitude absolutely unusual to me. And once, Mr. Vance, I remember quite distinctly that there was a stain of blood close to the mark. I didn't think anything of it at the time and just wiped it away.
I see. Alma Vance resumed his seat and invited his visitor to do the same.
And now, he resumed, you said, Mr. Davenant, that there are certain peculiar circumstances you wish to acquaint me with. Will you do so?
And so Davenant readjusted his collar and proceeded to tell his story. I will tell it as far as I can, without any reference to the occasional interruptions of Vance and myself. Paul Davenant, as I have said, was a man of wealth and position, and so, in every sense of the word, he was a suitable husband for Miss Jessica McThane, the young lady who eventually became his wife. Before coming to the incidents attending his loss of health, he had a great deal to recount about Miss McThane and her family history. She was of Scottish descent, and although she had certain characteristic features of her race, she was not really Scotch in appearance. Hers was the beauty of the far south rather than that of the highlands from which she had her origin. Names are not always suited to their owners, and Miss McThane's was peculiarly inappropriate. She had, in fact, been christened Jessica in a sort of pathetic effort to counteract her obvious departure from normal type. There was a reason for this which we were soon to learn. Miss McThane was especially remarkable for her wonderful red hair, hair such as one hardly ever sees outside of Italy, not the Celtic red. It was so long that it reached to her feet, and it had an extraordinary gloss upon it so that it seemed almost to have individual life of its own. Then she had just the complexion that one would expect with such hair, the purest ivory white, and not in the least marred by freckles, as is so often the case with red-haired girls. Her beauty was derived from an ancestress who had been brought to Scotland from some foreign shore. No one knew exactly whence. Davenant fell in love with her almost at once, and he had every reason to believe, in spite of her many admirers, that his love was returned. At this time he knew very little about her personal history. He was aware only that she was very wealthy in her own right, an orphan, and the last representative of a race that had once been famous in the annals of history, or rather infamous, for the McThanes had distinguished themselves more by cruelty and lust of blood than by deeds of chivalry. A clan of turbulent robbers in the past, they had helped to add many a blood-stained page to the history of their country. Jessica had lived with her father, who owned a house in London, until his death when she was about 15 years of age. Her mother had died in Scotland when Jessica was still a tiny child. Mr. McThane had been so affected by his wife's death that, with his little daughter, he had abandoned his Scotch estate altogether, or so it was believed, leaving it to the management of a bailiff, though indeed there was but little work for the bailiff to do, since there were practically no tenants left. Blackwick Castle had borne for many years a most unenviable reputation. After the death of her father, Miss McThane had gone to live with a certain Mrs. Meredith, who was a connection of her mother's. On her father's side, she had not a single relation left. Jessica was absolutely the last of a clan, once so extensive that intermarriage had been a tradition of the family, but for which the last 200 years had been gradually dwindling to extinction. Mrs. Meredith took Jessica into society, which would never have been her privilege had Mr. McThane lived, for he was a moody, self-absorbed man, and prematurely old, one who seemed worn down by the weight of a great grief. Well, I have said that Paul Davenant quickly fell in love with Jessica, and it was not long before he proposed for her hand. To his great surprise, for he had good reason to believe that she cared for him, he met with a refusal. Nor would she give any explanation, though she burst into a flood of pitiful tears. Bewildered and bitterly disappointed, he consulted Mrs. Meredith, with whom he happened to be on friendly terms, and from her he learnt that Jessica had already had several proposals, all from quite desirable men, but that one after another had been rejected. Paul consoled himself with the reflection that perhaps Jessica did not love them, whereas he was quite sure that she cared for himself. Under these circumstances, he determined to try again. He did so, and with better result. Jessica admitted her love, but at the same time she repeated that she would not marry him. Love and marriage were not for her. Then, to his utter amazement, she declared that she had been born under a curse, a curse which, sooner or later, was bound to show itself in her, and which, moreover, must react cruelly, perhaps fatally, upon anyone with whom she linked her life. How could she allow a man she loved to take such a risk? Above all, since the evil was hereditary, there was one point upon which she had quite made up her mind. No child should ever call her mother. She must be the last of her race indeed. Of course, Davenant was amazed and inclined to think that Jessica had got some absurd idea into her head, which a little reasoning on his part would dispel. There was only one other possible explanation. Was it lunacy she was afraid of? But Jessica shook her head. She did not know of any lunacy in her family. The ill was deeper, more subtle than that, and then she told him all that she knew. The curse, she made use of that word for want of a better, was attached to the ancient race from which she had her origin. Her father had suffered from it, and his father and grandfather before him. All three had taken to themselves young wives who had died mysteriously of some wasting disease within a few years. Had they observed the ancient family tradition of intermarriage, this might possibly not have happened, but in their case, since the family was so near extinction, this had not been possible. For the curse, or whatever it was, did not kill those who bore the name of MacThane. It only rendered them a danger to others. It was as if they absorbed from the blood-soaked walls of their fatal castle a deadly taint which reacted terribly upon those with whom they were brought into contact, especially their nearest and dearest. "Do you know what my father said we have it in us to become?" said Jessica with a shudder. "He used the word vampires. Paul, think of it. Vampires, preying upon the lifeblood of others." And then, when Davenant was inclined to laugh, she checked him. "No," she cried out. "It is not impossible. Think, we are a decadent race. From the earliest times our history has been marked by bloodshed and cruelty. The walls of Blackwick Castle are impregnated with evil. Every stone could tell its tale of violence, pain, lust, and murder. What can one expect of those who have spent their lifetime between its walls?" "But you have not done so," exclaimed Paul. "You have been spared that, Jessica. You were taken away after your mother died, and you have no recollection of Blackwick Castle, none at all. You need never set foot in it again." "I'm afraid the evil is in my blood," she replied sadly. "Although I am unconscious of it now, and as for not returning to Blackwick, I'm not sure I can help myself. At least that is what my father warned me of. He said there is something there, some compelling force, that will call me to it in spite of myself. But, oh, I don't know, and that is what makes it so difficult. If I could only believe that all this is nothing but an idle superstition, I might be happy again. For I have it in me to enjoy life, and I'm young, very young. But my father told me these things when he was on his deathbed." She added the last words on a low, awe-stricken tone. Paul pressed her to tell him all that she knew, and eventually she revealed another fragment of family history which seemed to have some bearing upon the case. It dealt with her own astonishing likeness to that ancestress of a couple of hundred years ago, whose existence seemed to have presaged the gradual downfall of the clan of the MacThanes. A certain Robert MacThane, departing from the traditions of his family, which demanded that he should not marry outside his clan, brought home a wife from foreign shores, a woman of wonderful beauty, who was possessed of glowing masses of red hair and a complexion of ivory whiteness, such as had more or less distinguished since then every female of the race born in the direct line. It was not long before this woman came to be regarded in the neighborhood as a witch. Queer stories were circulated abroad as to her doings, and the reputation of Blackwick Castle became worse than ever before. And then one day she disappeared. Robert MacThane had been absent upon some business for 24 hours, and it was upon his return that he found her gone. The neighborhood was searched, but without avail, and then Robert, who was a violent man and who had adored his foreign wife, called together certain of his tenants whom he suspected, rightly or wrongly, of foul play, and had them murdered in cold blood. Murder was easy in those days, yet such an outcry was raised that Robert had to take flight, leaving his two children in the care of their nurse, and for a long while Blackwick Castle was without a master. But its evil reputation persisted. It was said that Zayda the witch, though dead, still made her presence felt. Many children of the tenantry and young people of the neighborhood sickened and died, possibly of quite natural causes, but this did not prevent a mantle of terror settling upon the countryside, for it was said that Zayda had been seen, a pale woman clad in white, flitting about the cottages at night, and where she passed, sickness and death were sure to supervene. And from that time the fortune of the family gradually declined. Heir succeeded heir, but no sooner was he installed at Blackwick Castle than his nature, whatever it may previously have been, seemed to undergo a change. It was as if he absorbed into himself all the weight of evil that had stained his family name, as if he did indeed become a vampire, bringing blight upon any not directly connected with his own house. And so, by degrees, Blackwick was deserted of its tenantry. The land around it was left uncultivated. The farms stood empty. This had persisted to the present day, for the superstitious peasantry still told their tales of the mysterious white woman who hovered about the neighborhood, and whose appearance betokened death, and possibly worse than death. And yet it seemed that the last representatives of the MacThanes could not desert their ancestral home. Riches they had, sufficient to live happily upon elsewhere, but, drawn by some power they could not contend against, they had preferred to spend their lives in the solitude of the now half-ruined castle, shunned by their neighbors, feared and execrated by the few tenants that still clung to their soil. So it had been with Jessica's grandfather and great-grandfather. Each of them had married a young wife, and in each case their love story had been all too brief. The vampire spirit was still abroad, expressing itself, or so it seemed, through the living representatives of bygone generations of evil, and young blood had been demanded as the sacrifice. And to them had succeeded Jessica's father. He had not profited by their example, but had followed directly in their footsteps. And the same fate had befallen the wife whom he passionately adored. She had died of pernicious anemia, so the doctors said, but he had regarded himself as her murderer. But unlike his predecessors, he had torn himself away from Blackwick, and this for the sake of his child. Unknown to her, however, he had returned year after year, for there were times when the passionate longing for the gloomy, mysterious halls and corridors of the old castle, for the wild stretches of moorland and the dark pine woods, would come upon him too strongly to be resisted. And so he knew that for his daughter, as for himself, there was no escape. And he warned her, when the relief of death was at last granted to him, of what her fate must be. This was the tale that Jessica told the man who wished to make her his wife, and he made light of it, as such a man would, regarding it all as foolish superstition, the delusion of a mind overwrought. And at last, perhaps it was not very difficult, for she loved him with all her heart and soul, he succeeded in inducing Jessica to think as he did, to banish morbid ideas, as he called them, from her brain and to consent to marry him at an early date. "I'll take any risk you like," he declared. "I'll even go and live at Blackwick if you should desire it. To think of you, my lovely Jessica, a vampire! Why, I never heard such nonsense in my life." "Father said I'm very like Zayda the witch," she protested, but he silenced her with a kiss. And so they were married and spent their honeymoon abroad, and in the autumn Paul accepted an invitation to a house party in Scotland for the grouse shooting, a sport to which he was absolutely devoted, and Jessica agreed with him that there was no reason why he should forgo his pleasure. Perhaps it was an unwise thing to do, to venture to Scotland, but by this time the young couple, more deeply in love with each other than ever, had got quite over their fears. Jessica was redolent with health and spirits, and more than once she declared that if they should be anywhere in the neighborhood of Blackwick, she would like to see the old castle out of curiosity, and just to show how absolutely she had got over the foolish terrors that used to assail her. This seemed to Paul to be quite a wise plan, and so one day, since they were actually staying at no great distance, they motored over to Blackwick, and finding the bailiff, got him to show them over the castle. It was a great castellated pile, grey with age, and in places falling into ruin. It stood on a steep hillside, with the rock on which it seemed to form part, and on one side of it there was a precipitous drop to a mountain stream 100 feet below. The robber MacThanes of the old days could not have desired a better stronghold. At the back, climbing up the mountainside, were dark pine woods, from which here and there rugged crags protruded, and these were fantastically shaped, some like gigantic and misshapen human forms, which stood up as if they mounted guard over the castle and the narrow gorge, by which alone it could be approached. This gorge was always full of weird, uncanny sounds. It might have been a storehouse for the wind, which, even on calm days, rushed up and down as if seeking an escape, and it moaned among the pines and whistled in the crags and shouted derisive laughter as it was tossed from side to side of the rocky heights. It was like the plaint of lost souls. That is the expression Davenant made use of, the plaint of lost souls. The road, little more than a track now, passed through this gorge, and then, after skirting a small but deep lake, which hardly knew the light of the sun, so shut in was it by overhanging trees, climbed the hill to the castle. And the castle! Davenant used but a few words to describe it, yet somehow I could see the gloomy edifice in my mind's eye, and something of the lurking horror that it contained communicated itself to my brain. Perhaps my clairvoyant sense assisted me, for when he spoke of them, I seemed already acquainted with the great stone halls, the long corridors, gloomy and cold even on the brightest and warmest of days, the dark, oak-panelled rooms, and the broad central staircase up which one of the early MacThanes had once led a dozen men on horseback in pursuit of a stag which had taken refuge within the precincts of the castle. There was the keep, too, its walls so thick that the ravages of time had made no impression upon them, and beneath the keep were dungeons which could tell terrible tales of ancient wrong and lingering pain. Well, Mr. and Mrs. Davenant visited as much as the bailiff could show them of this ill-omened edifice, and Paul, for his part, thought pleasantly of his own Derbyshire home, the fine Georgian mansion replete with every modern comfort, where he proposed to settle with his wife. And so he received something of a shock when, as they drove away, she slipped her hand into his and whispered, "Paul, you promised, didn't you, that you would refuse me nothing?" She had been strangely silent till she spoke those words. Paul, slightly apprehensive, assured her that she had only to ask, but the speech did not come from his heart, for he guessed vaguely what she desired. She wanted to go and live at the castle, oh, only for a little while, for she was sure she would soon tire of it. But the bailiff had told her that there were papers, documents, which she ought to examine, since the property was now hers, and, besides, she was interested in this home of her ancestors, and wanted to explore it more thoroughly. Oh no, she wasn't in the least influenced by the old superstition. That wasn't the attraction. She had quite got over those silly ideas. Paul had cured her, and since he himself was so convinced that they were without foundation, he ought not to mind granting her her whim. This was a plausible argument, not easy to controvert. In the end, Paul yielded, though it was not without a struggle. He suggested amendments. Let him at least have the place done up for her. That would take time, or let them postpone their visit till next year, in the summer, not move in just as the winter was upon them. But Jessica did not want to delay longer than she could help, and she hated the idea of redecoration. Why, it would spoil the illusion of the old place, and, besides, it would be a waste of money since she only wished to remain there for a week or two. The Derbyshire house was not quite ready yet. They must allow time for the paper to dry on the walls. And so, a week later, when their stay with their friends was concluded, they went to Blackwick. The bailiff having engaged a few raw servants and generally made things as comfortable for them as possible, Paul was worried and apprehensive, but he could not admit this to his wife after having so loudly proclaimed his theories on the subject of superstition. They had been married 3 months at this time. 9 had passed since then, and they had never left Blackwick for more than a few hours. Till now, Paul had come to London alone.
"Over and over again," he declared. "My wife has begged me to go. With tears in her eyes, almost upon her knees, she has entreated me to leave her. But I have steadily refused unless she will accompany me. But that is the trouble, Mr. Vance. She cannot. There is something, some mysterious horror that holds her there as surely as if she were bound with fetters. It holds her more strongly even than it held her father. We found out that he used to spend 6 months at least of every year at Blackwick, months when he pretended that he was travelling abroad. You see, the spell, or whatever the accursed thing may be, never really relaxed its grip on him."
"Did you never attempt to take your wife away?" asked Vance.
"Yes, several times. But it was hopeless. She would become so ill as soon as we were beyond the limit of the estate that I invariably had to take her back. Once we got as far as Dorkirk, that is the nearest town, you know, and I thought I should be successful if only I could get through the night. But she escaped me. She climbed out of a window. She meant to go back on foot at night all those long miles. Then I have had doctors down, but it is I who wanted the doctors, not she. They have ordered me away, but I have refused to obey them till now."
"Has your wife changed at all, physically?" interrupted Vance. Davenant reflected.
"Changed?" he said. "Yes, but so subtly that I hardly know how to describe it. She is more beautiful than ever, and yet it isn't the same beauty, if you can understand me. I have spoken of her white complexion. Well, one is more than ever conscious of it now, because her lips have become so red. They are almost like a splash of blood upon her face, and the upper one has a peculiar curve that I don't think it had before. And when she laughs, she doesn't smile. Do you know what I mean? Then her hair, it has lost its wonderful gloss. Of course, I know she is fretting about me, but that is so peculiar too, for at times, as I have told you, she will implore me to go and leave her. And then perhaps only a few minutes later, she will wreathe her arms around my neck and say she cannot live without me. And I feel that there is a struggle going on within her, that she is only yielding slowly to the horrible influence, whatever it is, that she is herself when she begs me to go, but when she entreats me to stay, and it is then that her fascination is most intense. Oh, I can't help remembering what she told me before we were married, and that word." He lowered his voice. "The word vampire."
He passed his hand over his brow that was wet with perspiration.
"But that's absurd, ridiculous," he muttered. "These fantastic beliefs have been exploded years ago. We live in the 20th century."
A pause ensued. Then Vance said quietly,
"Mr. Davenant, since you have taken me into your confidence, since you have found doctors of no avail, will you let me try to help you? I think I may be of some use, if it is not already too late. Should you agree, Mr. Dexter and I will accompany you, as you have suggested, to Blackwick Castle as early as possible, by tonight's mail north. Under ordinary circumstances, I should tell you, as you value your life, not to return."
Davenant shook his head.
"That is advice which I should never take," he declared. "I had already decided, under any circumstances, to travel north tonight. I am glad that you both will accompany me."
And so it was decided. We settled to meet at the station, and presently Paul Davenant took his departure. Any other details that remained to be told he would put us in possession of during the course of the journey.
"A curious and most interesting case," remarked Vance when we were alone. "What do you make of it, Dexter?"
"I suppose," I replied cautiously, "that there is such a thing as vampirism, even in these days of advanced civilization. I can understand the evil influence that a very old person may have upon a young one if they happen to be in constant intercourse, the worn-out tissue sapping healthy vitality for their own support. And there are certain people, I could think of several myself, who seem to depress one and undermine one's energies, quite unconsciously, of course, but one feels somehow that vitality has passed from oneself to them. And in this case, when the force is centuries old, expressing itself in some mysterious way through Davenant's wife, is it not feasible to believe that he may be physically affected by it, even though the whole thing is sheerly mental? "You think, then," demanded Vance, "that it is sheerly mental? Tell me, if that is so, how do you account for the marks on Davenant's throat?" This was a question to which I found no reply, and though I pressed him for his views, Vance would not commit himself further just then. Of our long journey to Scotland, I need say nothing. We did not reach Blackwick Castle till late in the afternoon of the following day. The place was just as I had conceived it, as I have already described it, and a sense of gloom settled upon me as our car jolted us over the rough road that led through the Gorge of the Winds, a gloom that deepened when we penetrated into the vast, cold hall of the castle. Mrs. Davenant, who had been informed by telegram of our arrival, received us cordially. She knew nothing of our actual mission, regarding us merely as friends of her husband's. She was most solicitous on his behalf, but there was something strained about her tone, and it made me feel vaguely uneasy. The impression that I got was that the woman was impelled to everything that she said or did by some force outside herself. But, of course, this was a conclusion that the circumstances I was aware of might easily have conduced to. In every other aspect she was charming, and she had an extraordinary fascination of appearance and manner that made me readily understand the force of a remark made by Davenant during our journey. "I want to live for Jessica's sake. Get her away from Blackwick, Vance, and I feel that all will be well. I'd go through hell to have her restored to me as she was." And now that I had seen Mrs. Davenant, I realized what he meant by those last words. Her fascination was stronger than ever, but it was not a natural fascination, not that of a normal woman, such as she had been. It was the fascination of a Circe, of a witch, of an enchantress, and as such was irresistible. We had a strong proof of the evil within her soon after our arrival. It was a test that Vance had quietly prepared. Davenant had mentioned that no flowers grew at Blackwick, and Vance declared that we must take some with us as a present for the lady of the house. He purchased a bouquet of pure white roses at the little town where we left the train, for the motorcar had been sent to meet us. Soon after our arrival, he presented these to Mrs. Davenant. She took them, it seemed to me, nervously, and hardly had her hand touched them before they fell to pieces in a shower of crumpled petals to the floor. "We must act at once," said Vance to me when we were descending to dinner that night. "There must be no delay." "What are you afraid of?" I whispered. "Davenant has been absent a week," he replied grimly. "He is stronger than when he went away, but not strong enough to survive the loss of more blood. He must be protected. There is danger tonight."
"You mean from his wife?"
I shuddered at the ghastliness of the suggestion. "That is what time will show." Vance turned to me and added a few words with intense earnestness. "Mrs. Davenant, Dexter, is at present hovering between two conditions. The evil thing has not yet completely mastered her. You remember what Davenant said, how she would beg him to go away and the next moment entreat him to stay. She has made a struggle, but she is gradually succumbing, and this last week spent here alone has strengthened the evil. And that is what I have got to fight. Dexter, it is to be a contest of will, a contest that will go on silently till one or the other obtains the mastery. If you watch, you may see. Should a change show itself in Mrs. Davenant, you will know that I have won." Thus I knew the direction in which my friend proposed to act. It was to be a war of his will against the mysterious power that had laid its curse upon the house of MacThane. Mrs. Davenant must be released from the fatal charm that held her. And I, knowing what was going on, was able to watch and understand. I realized that the silent contest had begun even while we ate dinner. Mrs. Davenant ate practically nothing and seemed ill at ease. She fidgeted in her chair, talked a great deal, and laughed. It was the laugh without a smile, as Davenant had described it. And as soon as she was able to, she withdrew. Later, as we sat in the drawing room, I could feel the clash of wills. The air in the room felt electric and heavy, charged with tremendous but invisible forces. And outside, round the castle, the wind whistled and shrieked and moaned. It was as if all the dead and gone MacThanes, a grim army, had collected to fight the battle of their race. And all this while we four in the drawing room were sitting and talking, the ordinary commonplaces of after-dinner conversation. That was the extraordinary part of it. Paul Davenant suspected nothing, and I, who knew, had to play my part. But I hardly took my eyes from Jessica's face. When would the change come, or was it, indeed, too late? At last Davenant rose and remarked that he was tired and would go to bed. There was no need for Jessica to hurry. He would sleep that night in his dressing room and did not want to be disturbed. And it was at that moment, as his lips met hers in a good-night kiss, as she wreathed her enchantress arms